I am Roy Malloy, and you are listening to The Dawn of Crime, a podcast that I've thatched together from the gems of history that I've dug out of different archives in my pursuit of publishing a book series by the same title, The Dawn of Crime. And there's four books in the series at this point, which include each of them has between 12 to 14 biographies of different criminals in Australia's past who did those things that really were standout as historically interesting. But I often find that when we're looking at history, we get the histories of the kings and the queens, we get the histories of the politicians and the sports people, but we often overlook the people who did those things that we still get them from time to time now. But what was the backstory? What was the cause? What was the fallout from those people? And so The Dawn of Crime is dedicated to trying to offer biography to the criminals who came and went that did things that really should be remembered, should be talked about, and help us understand who we are. This is a podcast extra that I'm about to upload, and it's one of the podcast extras that I've been publishing on this podcast that isn't an interview. Now, I am always looking for people who have knowledge on a topic, and if you're one of them or you know someone, I want to meet them. I want to interview them if they have a topic or a specialty, particularly if they've published a book, if it touches on law, order, crime or punishment. They're my four things, and I want to talk to them. It doesn't matter what era. Could be the Russell Street bombings. It could be the at the moment the media is exploding about the Netherlands serial killer in Perth. Sorry, the Scarborough. Was it Cottesloe? Cottesloe. Get my WA right. But I would love to interview anybody with a good knowledge of their particular area of criminal history. But I have been uploading little bits and pieces because these extras are designed to talk about things that I discover from time to time. And as I discover them, I think to myself, surely that can't be, that's not a thing, is it? And so let me give an example. Cobblestones. Cobblestones were not just a thing, they were everywhere. And so you think to yourself, okay, well, that's because people were walking. No, they weren't. Horse-drawn carriages would routinely do their daily work on cobblestones. Now, cobblestones were usually bashed relatively smooth in, not quickly, but they were bashed smooth over time. But horse-drawn carriages, their wheels were made of wood, wagon wheels, and they had often a metal strip on the outside, but not always. So there's no shock absorption at all coming between those the clattering along the cobblestones and you, or your ride for that matter. And so I think to myself, I wonder what it'd like to have that experience. I've never had that experience. I would love to go a long distance in a hansom cab or a jinka. A jinka, there you go, there's another thing. A jinka is a two-wheeled horse-drawn kind of, it's a jinka, it's not a buggy, it's not a, it is own thing. So two wheels and you're sitting above it, and then the long poles attached to the horse. So that's a jinka. I'd love to go on an extended journey that travels across cobblestones. So there's all these different bits and pieces that I discover as I'm writing, and I thought I'd share some of them with you in these extras. So the first thing I'm going to talk about in this extra is the concept of boredom. Now, boredom was a big thing, and this is going to travel over a couple of different areas, and the first one is games. Now, I've got a whole bunch of kids, like so many children, too many maybe, I don't know, but I have six beautiful children who I love them, so they're precious, like we wouldn't trade them for less than, I don't know, a kilogram of cocaine maybe, but they are amazing, and we love like most of them most of the time, but they love gaming. Gaming is a thing that my brothers and I, we had an Atari XE. My older brother Scott was excellent at anything to do with any kind of sport or game. His coordination was just outstanding, and we had two different billiard tables in our life when we were growing up. I think I beat him once my whole life. So I remember those countless hours of playing billiards. But then I think as an adult, you have this capacity to want to, I don't know, engage more. So there's not a moment, day or night at the moment, where I can't occupy myself by just flipping open my phone. There has never been a time in the history of humankind where more raw data wasn't available to anybody, right? So we have this exquisite access to entertainments and occupations of every variety, day and night, now. But historically, people didn't. And when you also think about the people who couldn't read or write, it was exceedingly more the case. The boredom came in. So games became a very common part of people's lives. And we're not just talking any kind of game. We're talking things that weren't necessarily used today. The games that my kids play with online, you know, they settle in for countless hours staring at an iPad or a computer screen. In no way is that comparative to the games that I'm talking about. They kind of found their end after World War II, maybe the 1960s at the latest. You start losing these games from common Australian culture with the advent of radio and then television. That's my belief. I could be wrong. Sure, somebody's done a study on it, but more or less that's where I see the demise of games. Now, when I say games, let me explain what they are. We're looking at billiards. It would be the mother of all games. And the difference between a sport and a game, I would have to say it's possibly to do with exertion. Look, somebody else is going to, as soon as I post this up on social media as a link, somebody's going to post in the comments, "That's not the difference." And look, I hope they do that voice too. "That's not the difference." I don't know what the difference is technically between a game and a sport, but I would imagine that sports require physical athleticism of some kind, whereas a game is probably more restricted to very minimal movement. Let me give you an example, is cards or dice games. Now, dice is probably the oldest one that I can come up with, and very famously, they were taken, they're very small, they can be travelled easily. They can be made easily, and they would travel with people on board ships a lot. And so you're thinking about somebody, two guys sitting there for hours and hours and hours and hours, and it becomes a matter of who can roll the highest number. It's that simple. That's your simplest translation of a dice game. And then throw into that a mix where you can have counters, or you can have, you know, a board that goes with the dice, and you've got the advent of a slightly more interesting game. And they go back to Greek and Roman cultures as well. So then cards are the other half of that, I guess, because both of them attract a lot of gambling. And there's, a perception that whoever gets the greatest outcome is in some way better, and therefore they can claim the winnings of a bet to see who can roll the highest number or have the best hand. So games are a big thing, but then in a society kind of way, you can play those games at home. But then there's a category of games, I guess, that aren't necessarily domestic. And they're those games that you'll find in pubs and saloons. And they're also another thing, and I've talked a little bit about them in previous podcasts. Saloons and pubs fade away a little bit as the comfort of homes increases. People didn't necessarily have very warm houses in the past in the winter, and they certainly were very hot and stifling and poorly ventilated in hot weather. And so if you're also very poor, you're not going to have the money to necessarily buy wood or coal for your fire. So then games become a great pastime in pubs. So you've got the ability to play a game, and these will include, like I said, billiards, but also a swag of games that we don't necessarily have now, including darts, hooky. Do you remember hooky? It's like a circular board, like a dart board, but it had L-shaped nails sticking out of it with numbers, and you throw little rubber rings onto it, and they would hook on, necessitating the name, hooky. And then you'd have quoits is another very popular one, or horseshoes is very similar, where you have a stake driven into the ground, and you're throwing horseshoes at it to try and make them stop there, or quoits, which are made of, it's like a ring made of woven hemp rope, and you've got to try and get it on top of the spike. So games are a very different part of life back then, and I guess I'm going to use this as a segue through to boredom, because like I said, now I can flip my phone open day or night and I can be occupied. And I love nothing more than the Zen feeling of being able to just scroll through page after page of lines of data looking for a name or a date of birth. Like, as a researcher, for me, that is bliss. In fact, if anything, I'm not bored enough. I want more time to myself to do, to research. But I'm constantly bothered by work and having to do things. So what happens is I've got this ability to be occupied day or night. But prior to World War II, which is a bit of a game changer, because the technologies that come out of war are typically, they change things a lot. So, like, you go to war, and all of a sudden, the government throws huge amounts of money at developing technologies that can kill people. And then after war, we get to use them for civilian life. And naturally, radio and television are chief among them. But prior to really World War I, when we didn't have radio, you get this kind of... it's a way of living where you are bored. And I think a good example of this is the Big Brother house. So in the late 90s, early 2000s, Big Brother, that TV show where they put a bunch of people inside one house where they film them, but they don't have access to any outside stimulus, and they get more and more bored over the days that pass, and they start acting out. Now, in some ways, that will also be because they want television attention, and that's arguably why they've gone on in the first place. But in that environment, you also see these erratic and strange behaviours because they're just bored. And then we see that a lot more in the past when it comes to crime. You see, crime is often committed, and I believe because people are often just bored and also uneducated. So the boredom kicks in where, you know, you haven't had anything to read, or you've got no stimulation for weeks and weeks and weeks, or, you know, your whole life for that matter. And then you find yourself in a chair in your lounge room. What do? You go outside maybe, all right. Look to the garden, all right. I think isolation through COVID has given us all a really good glimpse as to what this feels like. And then you might see somebody leaning over the fence, it's your neighbour, and say, hey, how you doing? And those conversations go through all the normal things as to what you like doing and all your past experiences, and then there's nothing else to talk about, even then. And you find yourself talking about the most ridiculously inane things, like, oh, did you see what she was wearing? Right? And so gossip becomes interesting. And things that we don't do so readily these days, because we have things to occupy us, they were there, gossip chief among them. So boredom was a real thing that I think we are privileged to not have to tolerate as much or at all. But, you know, in that context, games and card games, I don't know. So then this is the last thing. There's no segue between what I've just said and what I'm about to say. So I'll just jump right into it. Is buttons and zippers. Buttons and zippers. So we take for granted zippers particularly, and Velcro for that matter. Velcro is a more recent invention where a guy took his dog out into the field and the dog came back and its fur was covered in clover burrs. Now, clover is like, you know, four-leaf clover, and the burr is the thing that the seeds are in, and the plant has designed a way to make its own seeds travel by making its seed pod like a tiny little spiral, and the outside, it's like a flat plate, and the outside of it, the perimeter, has all these tiny little hooks on it, and that's a clover burr. And he looked at the hooks, and he looked at his dog, and looked at the hooks, and he looked at his dog, and he thought, I've got an idea. So that's how we get Velcro. And I've got to say, I don't believe I own any clothing with Velcro. In fact, I'm going to hazard to say, if you have shoes with Velcro, you're possibly out of fashion. That's all I'm going to say on that topic. But buttons and zips, most certainly. Now, I'm a buttons guy. I do love buttons. I love them on jeans, down the front. I love them in any context. I prefer not to have zips if I don't have to. But like anybody else, I've got zips, you know, aplenty. But buttons, historically, they go back as far as clothes go back. the cheapest way people would make buttons were out of wood. What they'd do is they'd find a stick that was the radius that they wanted it, and they cut a disc out of the stick and drill two holes in it. That's your quintessential historical. More buttons were made like that than still have been made today any other way. And then you'd sand it against the rock and make it all nice. But wooden buttons like that, that is how buttons begin. But then zips are also very new. They're just before World War One. You got 1913, the World's Fair in America in Chicago. And it was introduced to the world at the World's Fair. World War One accelerated its popularity because it's a very handy way to get a soldier in and out of his uniform. But really, buttons were a thing of the past, and everything was buttoned. Now, with that comes something perhaps that, like, we have buttons, so you can imagine that. But then with buttons, there's a bit of give. The more you use a button, the more it kind of lets go a little bit of that bit of cotton that holds it onto the garment. So the cotton that's stitched through the holes in the button and then back and forth to the garment, the more you use it, it starts to give a little bit. And so let's also then assume that you've put on weight or lost weight, and losing weight was a big thing of the past as well. You're a bit, you know, you lost a bit of money, or times are tough and you haven't eaten as much, you've lost weight, your garment is now baggy. A lot of the time, people couldn't just go down to the local Kmart and get a replacement. Clothes were they're far more special. They were rare. They were hard to get hold of. And so one of the things that people would do for clothing is they would wear what's called mend-ups. And a mend-up is where somebody takes a secondhand piece of clothing they've bought and they'll unstitch it at every panel. They'll measure you and they'll restitch it to meet your physical shape. So that's a mend up, right? But let's say they don't quite get it right and it's a bit too big. One of the ways that they take care of that is with dressmaker pins. So exactly the same as we know pins to be now. It's like a long piece of, well, not long, 3 or 4 centimeter long piece of very thin wire. They shape the end of it so it's like a head. And this was often done just by twisting it. It wasn't even, you know, formed into a stud. And then they sharpen the other end. That's a pin, quintessential pin. And you would ultimately use that to fold the fabric and you would pin it together so that it held. But there are so, so many people using pins. I mean, crazy amounts of people using pins in the Victorian and Edwardian eras, that you can still take a magnet down along, well, I'm in Victoria, in Australia, down along the Yarra River. I've seen some people magnet fishing from time to time, and you run a magnet along there, it will still pull pins, dressmaker pins out now from Melbourne's earliest days. And along the foreshore of the Thames, where you see those mudlarking videos, they constantly come out with bucket loads of pins. So buttons and zips were also something that really have changed in their way of use as we've had the affluence to have more clothing and better access to it. So guys, this has been another extra upload. I really hope you've enjoyed it. It's been something I enjoy doing. But I will be uploading some more bits and pieces very soon. I'm really grateful to everybody that's purchased a copy of my latest book, which is called The Gangs of Melbourne, which looks at the terror that push gangs rained upon particularly Melbourne and Sydney in its early days. It talks about Squizzy Taylor and the Taylor Push, but it's available online, so all you've got to do is just get off this podcast, stop listening to it as soon as you can, and Google Roy Malloy, M-A-L-O-Y, Roy Malloy and author. You may come up with my Facebook page. Do like that page, make sure you hit like, because I publish a bunch of written stuff there that I don't talk about here. But also do make sure you check out the Dawn of Crime book series, and The Gangs of Melbourne is the most recent Dawn of Crime book. Guys, it's been a pleasure uploading this, and please do make sure you hit follow on whatever device, whatever platform you're listening to right now. Make sure you follow the podcast and give it a rating wherever you can. Thank you so much, guys, and stay safe and stay well.